kotna kotnumiortqo qayuukigillait
we do not put a limit on how many cattle or how many cows or how much food should outsiders have. We do not make any regulations on that. When we try to hunt and provide ourselves and feed our family, our children, somebody comes around and tells us, if you catch birds, if you catch moose, or if you gather food, we will put you in jail. We have been promised punishment for trying to survive.
The subsistence way of life continues to be vital to villages all over Alaska. Monumental changes in the law came with Alaska statehood. And then in 1971, Congress passed ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, with more regulations. Now Alaska's native peoples are trying to develop laws that meet their needs. This is holding our ground.
Funding for Holding Our Ground is provided by the Alaska Humanities Forum, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Rural Alaska Community Action Program, the North Slope Borough, and Zients Pertl Law Firm.
The people would go out to a certain area, they would harvest the abalone. In would come the divers from the commercial vessels, and they would move into this area and clean it out. The people went to the Department of Fish and Game and they said, we are going to our traditional area to get abalone, and we are being competed with unfairly by people with more elaborate equipment. And they were told to get some diving equipment themselves. Well, the solution isn't to get some diving equipment themselves. The solution is to develop a legal mechanism to protect the local indigenous use from outside intervention, if you will, or outside exploitation. And the issue that's raised is, whose resource is it? Is it the public's resource? Is it the state's resource? Is it the nation's resource?
Native peoples never had to consider such questions until Russia sold Alaska to the United States. There is plenty of evidence suggesting the Russians thought they were selling only trading rights and a few forts. The Americans thought they bought all of Alaska and its resources. Tom Lawner.
With the coming of American dominion over the land, and without the consent or knowledge of Alaska Native people, their wealth had been usurped by the American government. Lands, waters, fish, wildlife, minerals, and forests all passed into government hands and were converted into common property resources, that is, wealth held by the government on behalf of all Americans. Over the last two centuries, millions of immigrants from Europe and elsewhere have come to America and were awarded citizenship. To my knowledge, none have been required to surrender at their point of entry into the country all of their wealth to the government for common use in order to obtain citizenship. That seems to me to be the unwritten contract, an exchange of great wealth for simple citizenship.
As more immigrants came to Alaska, lands were used less and less freely by the native peoples. The most dramatic changes came with statehood in 1959. A year later, the state took control of fish and game management from the federal government. In 1971, Congress passed ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. That act extinguished Aboriginal land title along with Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights. Alaska Natives were left with about one-tenth of the land they had traditionally used and occupied. But the land was not given to individuals or tribal groups. It is held instead by profit-making native corporations created by the Claims Act. Two major forces accelerated the Land Claims Settlement Act. Alaska wanted to select statehood lands, and oil companies wanted North Slope oil. There was a great deal of pressure to settle.
The purchasing party, the United States, was interested primarily in extracting resources from the land, not settling on the land.
Tom Lawner.
The compensated party, Alaska Natives, was relinquishing rights to the rewards of that extraction, but did not intend to relinquish rights to chase and harvest the wild resources which traversed or inhabited all the lands.
Native corporation lands are now treated as private property in the eyes of the law. The corporation decides what happens on native lands. Betty Thomas Denny of Tanacross.
Because of the land claim, I think it restricted the land use to many of our people. I know that currently people can't trap, hunt, fish, or even pick berries anywhere because they have this fear of trespassing.
We cannot live without our land, without trapping, without fishing, without hunting.
Catherine Atla of Hoosley.
If they ever tell us where not to go or where not to trap, that's when it's going to get tough. Because we've been living like our ancestors all these years. And if we cannot do that no more, there's going to be a lot of unhappy people, unhealthy mostly.
Marie Adams of Barrow.
There are traditional subsistence laws, I mean, within the communities. I mean, they have their own laws, basically their own structure on how they hunt, what is acceptable, what is not. And what's been happening the last several years is with the new federal government, the state government coming in and basically imposing laws without clearly understanding or going out to see what is out there has created a lot of confusion.
Subsistence is more than hunting, fishing, and gathering. It is the work of many people in the villages, and it carries with it cultural and spiritual traditions. Chief Jonathan Solomon of Fort Yukon.
We are not a visitor upon these lands. We are in the same ecosystem as the animal on these lands. The caribou is part of the Kuchin people religion, but we also believe that the population of the Kuchin people in the Yukon Flat goes up and down with the numbers of these animals. This is why it's very important to us when we talk about the porcupine caribou herd, that it be protected for our generations to come, because this is our belief.
When the Claims Act extinguished subsistence hunting and fishing rights, the state was left to handle it. Alaska Natives worked very hard to get subsistence activities recognized by state and federal law. Caleb Pungawi of Nome.
This extinguishment should not have been accepted. It is surprising, though, that after the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, there were civil acts that were passed by the Congress that either provided for protection or provided for provisions of subsistence hunting and fishing for Alaska Natives.
Pungawi refers to ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, passed by Congress in 1980. It defines subsistence users as rural residents and demands they get priority. The state of Alaska knew ANILCA was coming, and in 1978, the state legislature passed the Subsistence Priority Act, which gave subsistence users preference in times of scarcity. Assistant Attorney General Larry Spengler.
Before 1978, as long as you caught it and ate it, basically, it was subsistence. It was personal use. But now, subsistence use is defined as customary and traditional use.
The state has trouble defining customary and traditional use, the language used in ANILCA law. Tom Lawner was the first to head the Alaska Fish and Game Subsistence Division when it was created in 1979.
While it talks about customary and traditional uses, it very rapidly reduces those to economic uses only and then proceeds to limit those.
Lawner's Subsistence Division created regulations to define subsistence criteria. Basically, a long-term pattern of consistent resource use near the user's home, traditional methods of handling and preserving, along with sharing the resource and the traditional knowledge handed down through generations.
In fact, we're trying to get back into patterns of tradition and custom and so on and get off of this purely economic mode that the state had adopted in its very protective subsistence law. Laws that were used to control subsistence prior to the state subsistence law were done essentially without any specific recognition for subsistence and what would be meant by customary and traditional use or just the basic necessities of life in rural Alaska.
Some urban hunters disagreed with the state regulations. In 1982, an initiative to repeal the state subsistence law was brought before Alaska voters and soundly rejected. State regulations remained intact. Some urban subsistence users had already been accommodated under the existing rules, but in 1985, the state's highest court broadened the subsistence use category to more urban residents. That decision did not comply with the federal ANILCA law, which clearly states subsistence is done by rural residents. State Senator Mitch Abood made sure no action was taken in 1985 on 9 subsistence bills intended to correct the law.
Yes, I guess you could call it my fault. I said those bills are going to stay right in this committee until someone who will come to their senses and come together from all walks of this thing, this problem, and sit down and discuss it, and each one give a little bit.
In the absence of a new law, emergency regulations were put in place by the Fish and Game Boards, regulations that emphasize historical use and local residents. Some urban hunters felt slighted by those emergency regulations, and rural subsistence users feared increased competition. Assistant Secretary of the Interior William Horn notified the governor that Alaska is out of compliance with federal law regulating subsistence because it has been extended to urban hunters and fishers. Unless the state comes back into compliance by June 1, 1986, the federal government will take over fish and game management. Senator Abood says he will introduce a subsistence bill early in 1986 to comply with the federal law. Customary and traditional use must be defined by the state, along with a system that recognizes different situations. Subsistence Division Chief Benke says that subsistence users can be protected on a priority basis, and there will be plenty of opportunity for other hunters and fishers as well. Some urban hunters disagree and say they will take their case of equal access to state and federal courts. In several other states where Indians lost subsistence rights, they have been reinstated. State, federal, and corporation rules don't always make sense to people living in the villages. While most non-native hunters are accustomed to getting a permit for one animal, traditional customs are quite different. Daryl Trigg of Nome.
It's always been our custom to allow the good hunters to catch more than the current limits and share with people who were berry pickers or green pickers or fishermen, who in turn would share their crop and catch with the hunters. You know, the lands that were to be ours are now controlled by a board of directors with restrictions on the use of that land by about every federal and state agency that exists. Now, they don't seem to recall that the Eskimo has lived and survived up here for thousands of years without scarring the land. Before they came with their laws and their regulations, there was always a good balance of game to feed our people. It is proven, you know, that the Eskimo has never hunted themselves out of game and probably never will.
Subsistence is a living, breathing, dynamic human activity.
Tom Lawner.
Regulatory regimes tend to place the steel web of exactness on the activity in the form of exact definitions, exact locations, exact numbers. This exactness cannot respond to the ever-changing human needs or ever-changing environmental conditions which comprise subsistence.
The arbitrary setting of seasons by the state is sometimes seen as inappropriate. The traditional reason for hunting at a certain time is different than the state or federal government's reason for a season. Jimmy Walker of Holy Cross.
The fish and the moose meat, and it's pretty much our diet. Like up north, they got to have their whale. Same thing, you know. That's our regular diet. We're restricted to hunting seasons, you know. And that's making it hard on the village. We like to see more local control for the elders and the middle age. It's really a problem. Some have went out and got arrested when they had nothing to eat. They were just scrounging for the next meal. You know, what are you going to do? You going to leave your family hungry when there's a big healthy moose running by? And see, I'll tell you what you can eat and can't eat? When do you eat that meat?
Our culture is not based on beef. It's not based on corn.
Sheldon Ketchatag of Unalakleet.
It's based on those resources which have gotten us from primitive times to where we are today. And even now, in this very modern age, we still derive approximately 70% of the food we need from the land and not from the supermarket.
The economy is now part of remote Alaska, but to a limited degree. Elders tend to depend more on subsistence than younger people who are more acquainted with Western foods. Food is only one part of subsistence living affected by relatively new regulations. Ellie Stickman of Nulato.
Before the land claims came, my people before me used to go out into the woods and get whatever they want from the land for free. It's there to use, the wood, the fish in the river, the moose, the berries, tea, everything. It was just there to be used. And now, the way it is, we have to find out whose land it is first before we can do anything, before we can get logs, before we can even go out and get wood to burn for our winter heat.
Judge Thomas Berger traveled to villages in all regions of Alaska to ask people about the effects of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Berger recommended that tribal governments should have exclusive jurisdiction over fish and wildlife taken on native lands, and share management with the federal and state governments on other lands.
In Alaska, native societies, large and small, were erected on a subsistence base. Today, subsistence gives continuity to village life, and given the limited opportunities for wage or salaried employment in rural Alaska, is seen to be the key to the survival of village life and village society. Although ANCSA extinguished Aboriginal subsistence hunting and fishing rights, Alaska Natives still regard subsistence as their birthright. Even those not engaged in subsistence regard it as essential to their future well-being.
We're really concerned about our lifestyle in the villages due to no development and jobs for our young people.
Jimmy Walker.
In this immediate area, it looks pretty glum. So it's getting back to the issue of subsistence. We got to have that, otherwise we're not going to survive.
Throughout the world, nations have taken strong measures to protect the subsistence lifestyles of indigenous peoples. Canada has given exclusive rights to fur-bearing animals and shared jurisdiction of moose and caribou to the natives of Quebec and the Western Arctic. In Alaska, natives have taken the lead to protect several species that are used for subsistence. In 1977, the International Whaling Commission, supported by the United States government, banned bowhead whaling. Marie Adams.
When they were asked to stop whaling, it was incomprehensible, and people were deeply hurt.
Burton Rexford is a barrel whaling captain.
In spite of the native people's knowledge of the great bowhead whale, the Eskimos have been repeatedly put on a chopping block by the world scientists and regulatory government agencies.
Eskimo whaling captains formed the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and convinced the U.S. government they should have some whales. A stringent quota system was devised by the International Whaling Commission. In 1981, the federal government signed over management authority to the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. The North Slope Borough set up a scientific advisory committee and helped coordinate research on the bowhead whale. In 1985, the International Whaling Commission recognized the whaling captain's request for an enlarged bowhead quota. In 1975, oil development in Alaska's North Slope brought Native peoples together on both sides of the Alaska-Canada border. The Alaskans negotiated a position to secure the Arctic Wildlife Range and then got together again with Canadians from eight villages in 1982. Jonathan Solomon.
Indigenous people met in Arctic Village, and we formed what is known today as the International Porcupine Caribou Commission. And we filed it with the United Nations. We did not file it with the United States. We filed it with the United Nations under their agreement in Stockholm.
Victor Matander is a land claims negotiator for the Council of Yukon Indians.
We want to ensure that there is cooperation in terms of the management of the herd and its habitat, and to, first of all, ensure that there is conservation of the herd itself with the view of providing ongoing subsistence needs of the native users. Secondly, is to provide for the native users to participate in the porcupine caribou management. Thirdly, is to recognize and protect certain harvesting rights of the porcupine caribou for the native users, while at the same time acknowledging that there are other users, non-native users of the herd itself. Also, to provide communication amongst governments and government to native users and amongst native user communities.
The state of Alaska has worked directly with the International Porcupine Caribou Commission, and it led to a meeting with the Alaska Governor in October of 1983. Jonathan Solomon.
The governor of the state of Alaska called us into his office and said, "You guys been working on this caribou treaty for many years." He says, "About time we move on with it." And he formed the task force. And today, with the Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Game of the state of Alaska, we have worked out the wording.
The remaining steps will be worked out with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then the U.S. State Department will negotiate the treaty with the Canadian government. In 1984, natives living on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta developed international agreements to protect geese populations. Harold Spark heads Nunam Tlusti, a non-profit corporation which represents natural resource issues for 56 villages in southwest Alaska.
The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service showed up and said, the sky is falling, and the native people of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are responsible for it, solely responsible for the loss of all these geese. And the first thing that came out of the several of the elders' mouth was, wait a minute, they're talking about these animals that we eat. Now, when we were young, when these animals were strong in numbers, the little birds that fly around like clouds were very strong, too. Nobody eats them. How come they are very few in number, too? They go to the very same places that these big birds go to. And maybe what these guys are saying is that they're looking for somebody to blame all this problem on. So our concern is, number one, we got to make sure that we're not stuck with the onus of being responsible for this whole thing. But number two, we have to watch out for our children.
The villagers discovered there were problems in different parts of the flyway.
We link take in the Yukon Delta to conversion of wetlands in the Central Valley of California to the take by gringos out of Los Angeles, going down into Mexico and hunting without any enforcement whatsoever.
Helicopter interference was stopped at one feeding ground in Alaska. California bought back wetlands in California's Central Valley, and the Mexican government agreed they would pay attention to habitats and record the take of waterfowl there.
Our villages voluntarily agreed to lay down their guns and to stop taking eggs in exchange for California reducing their take by 50%. So we went around the federal government in order to get this taker-to-taker agreement, and then California supported our habitat concerns. Lo and behold, our villages complied, California's complied. And again, the guiding principle is birds at the turn of the century. That's what they wanted, our villages wanted.
People are watching closely to see if this taker-to-taker agreement will allow geese populations to increase for people who depend on them. Subsistence users say that state and federal authorities should rely more on their knowledge and experience in game management. Woodrow Morrison, Jr. of Heidelberg.
The people's lives are governed by these natural cycles. That seasons do change. Sometimes you have an early winter here in Anchorage, sometimes you don't. Well, the animals' lives are geared to those changes rather than to on a calendar. And if people are going to be able to live in a time-honored way and be able to pay respect to their relatives in a proper way, then they should be able to follow those cycles.
While the state subsistence law is currently in turmoil, there are success stories to be found where subsistence users have made their case to the state game board. Fred Bismarck is chairman of the Fish and Game Board from Tyonek.
This year, I spent 21 days at the hearings, and we finally got our winter moose hunt. But the winter moose hunt it depends on the snow. We have a different herd of moose that live up on the hills. They don't come off the hills until there's heavy snow, and the board made it flexible for us. If the heavy snow came in November, they could have had the season in November. But if the snow don't come till January, then we got the last 15 days in January for the January moose hunt.
Non-subsistence hunters have access to the same moose during a regular fall season. Local control of resources is important to people wherever they live. Next week, a look at how Alaska Native peoples exert those governmental powers in a program called Sovereignty, how it works. Please join us. For Holding Our Ground, this is Adeline Raboff. This program is produced by Jim Sykes, written by Bill Dubay and Sue Burris, also edited and researched by Sue Burris. Special thanks to the community of Gamble for dancing, singing, and drumming, and also to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. For more information about this and other programs in this series, write to Western Media Concepts, P.O. Box 215, Anchorage, Alaska, 99510. Holding Our Ground is a production of Western Media Concepts, which is solely responsible for the content.
Funding for Holding Our Ground is provided by the Alaska Humanities Forum, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Rural Alaska Community Action Program, the North Slope Borough, and Zients Pertl Law Firm.